rehabilitation of sorts, a safe environment where I could rebuild my identity and work through my unique grief experience. The families of the victims were always on my mind, especially how difficult it must have been for them to try to resume some semblance of a normal life after what Dylan had done. As time went by, my constant anguish began to feel almost comical. Stashed handkerchiefs dropped out of notepads, calendars, sleeves, and my pockets when I stood up. I could always be relied upon to provide a Kleenex pack. Seasonal allergies? Ask Sue. I hoped for kindness, and for the most part I got it, more than I felt I deserved. But not everyone was kind and understanding, and that was okay too. The denial I had been living in, especially the belief that Dylan had been coerced into participating, or that he hadn't directly committed any of the violence, was a natural response, but it was no longer appropriate. Being back in the world meant confronting the enormity of what Dylan had done. I sensed judgment and anger and pain from some of the people I worked with. Friends told me when someone spoke unkindly behind my back. Some people avoided me or confronted me indirectly. One of these incidents stands out in my mind, not because it was the worst confrontation or the most devastating comment anyone made, but because it articulated exactly what I feared everyone was thinking, not to mention my own worst fears about myself. I went along on a monitoring visit of a vocational program our office had funded in a small rural high school outside Denver. Being in a high school was difficult for me, and I fought tears the entire visit, especially when we stepped into a large computer lab where a group of happy, productive kids were working. We introduced ourselves to the computer teacher, a young man not much older than his students, and congratulated him on the thriving program. When I said my name, he stared into my face with intensity. When one of our team members complimented his ability to keep so many machines in good working order, he said, "Well, you get to know the machines. After a while, it's like being a good parent." At that, he turned away from the person who'd asked the question so he could make searing eye contact with me. When you're a good parent, you just sort of know what your kids are up to. Those experiences hurt, and I hated them. But as much as I wanted to flee whenever the topic of Columbine surfaced, I could not spend my life walking out of meetings to avoid comments I did not want to hear, or not going to them at all so I'd never encounter a situation that might cause me distress. Despite the horrendous maelstrom of emotions I was living with, I wasn't the only one hurting. I had to face the magnitude of Dylan's actions and accept how his terrible, violent choices had affected others. Each time I recovered from an uncomfortable encounter, I took another step toward accepting the totality of what Dylan had done. Whether people supported or judged me, being back to work put me shoulder to shoulder with the community my son tried to destroy. I'd always been conscious of the opinions of others. Suddenly, their approval was paramount. I felt sure my own behavior was being evaluated and judged and used to explain how Dylan could have killed and maimed. Always mildly obsessive about my work, I entered a period of intense perfectionism. I would make no errors, commit no miscommunication. I would catch every typo, do every project better than I needed to do it, and with time to spare. It wasn't enough to be competent or normal. I had to convince others I had not caused the craziness exhibited by my son. If I did make a small mistake, I'd often become too upset to continue working. Whenever someone asked me a question, I felt criticized. Driving, I worried I'd accidentally injure or kill someone in my distraction, cementing the world's conviction that I didn't deserve to draw breath. I looked at photographs of other people's happy families on their desks and wondered, what did they do that I didn't? At the same time, I felt defensive and desperate to show people Dylan had been loved, that I'd been a good mother, and that despite our closeness, I'd had no idea what he was planning or the slightest suspicion he was capable of such a barbaric act. Of course, I was assigning to others all the negative feelings I had about myself. I had raised a murderer without knowing it, a person with such a faulty moral compass that he'd committed an atrocity. I was a fool, a sucker, a dolt. I hadn't even been one of those cool parents who smokes pot with their kids or introduces them to their groovy boyfriends. No, I'd been an everybody-sits-down-for-family-dinner kind of a parent. And I want to meet your friends and their parents before you spend the night at their house, kind of a parent. What good had it done? I remember driving a kindergarten-age Dylan back to the grocery so he could return a piece of penny candy he'd taken without paying for it, and how grateful I'd been when the manager soberly accepted Dylan's apology and took the candy from his small hand instead of rewarding his theft by allowing him to keep it. I thought of all the times I'd called the mom hosting a sleepover to find out what movie she was planning to show. More than once, I'd asked for a less violent selection. Why had I bothered trying to establish a contextual framework for violence when the whole world could see how miserably I failed to protect my son and so many others from it? For 20 years, signing permission slips and designing elaborate Easter egg hunts and making sure my boys had sneakers that fit had been the touchstones of my life, around which I had fit my work and my art and my marriage. Now I had to ask, what had the point of any of it been? It's probably impossible to raise a child without having regrets. After murder-suicide, the guilt and second-guessing are constant, intolerable companions. When I went home from work at night, I paged obsessively through our family photo albums. There were the trips to the dairy farm, the natural history museum, the park, the ordinary stuff of a happy middle-class childhood. I was relieved to see how often in the photos Dylan was hugged, tickled, cuddled, or otherwise touched with love. I daydreamed about buttonholing strangers on the street and showing them the albums. There, I wanted to say, see, I'm not crazy. Look at how happy we were. But the sight of Dylan's arm casually slung around Tom's neck while he grinned and called out to me behind the camera would once again tap into that seemingly endless river of sorrow. In the old movie Gaslight, the Charles Boyer character is trying to drive his wife, who is played by Ingrid Bergman, insane. He moves artwork and jewelry and plants items he claims she's stolen in her purse. It works. When his wife can no longer trust her own perceptions of reality, she begins to break down. I thought of Gaslight often in those days as I tried to reconstruct an identity for myself. I had thought I'd been a good mother. I had loved and been proud of my son. Nothing I saw when Dylan was alive made me think he was suffering from problems of any real magnitude. Nor, looking back, could I see any obvious screaming signs. The cognitive dissonance was intense. When you're a good parent, you just sort of know what your kids are up to. The teacher's comment stung me more than hateful invective would have. Not because I didn't believe it, but because I did. Journal entry, May 1999. Tom mostly wonders if we will ever be reunited with him. This is on Tom's mind constantly. He says he'd feel comforted if he knew he'd see him again. I think a lot about where Dylan is and whether his evil actions prevent him from resting in peace, in God's care. I hope there is a forgiving God who will recognize that he was a child. My friend Sharon lost a child to suicide, and she urged me to find a suicide loss survivor's support group. I was desperate to be among people who would listen and sympathize and not judge, but I could not imagine walking into a room filled with strangers and talking about what Dylan and Eric had done. More to the point, as Gary Lozo had pointed out, if our lawsuits went to trial, another support group participant might have to serve as a witness. I felt I had caused enough damage already. The isolation was terrible. My anxiety levels were sky high, and I felt very disconnected. We were not in communication with the Harrises. The one person in the world who might have been able to understand what I was going through was Tom, but the divide that had sprung up between us in the earliest days after the tragedy continued to widen. This is not unusual, of course. Although the statistics you've heard about the likelihood of divorce after the death of a child are probably inflated, most marriages do suffer immense disruption. One often cited reason is that men and women may grieve the loss differently. Men tend to grieve the loss of the person the child would have become, while women tend to grieve the child they remember. That divide was true for us. I incessantly reviewed memories of Dylan as a baby, a toddler, a child, and a teenager, while Tom focused on everything Dylan would never do because he was dead. This focus on Dylan's lost future chafed me, as if Tom were pressuring Dylan posthumously to fill his fatherly expectations. The things we fought about seem unimportant to me now. We were lashed together, back to back, at the center of this terrible storm. But sometimes it felt worse to be with someone than to be alone. Our coping mechanisms were often in conflict, too. I had always been more social and extroverted, while Tom preferred solitude. The tragedy exaggerated our respective orientations. As stressful as it was to expose myself to hatred and judgment, my re-emergence into the world at large exposed me to kindness and generosity, too. Interacting with other people also meant my denial could not become entrenched. An unpleasant conversation might hurt my feelings and set me back temporarily, but ultimately, I believed engaging with the outside world was helping me to come to terms with reality. While I was pushing myself to get back out in the world, though, Tom was becoming increasingly private. I wanted to throw open the doors, and Tom wanted to circle the wagons. More and more, I found I was leaving him to it. Journal entry, August 1999. I sang sad songs and cried all the way to work. I could barely walk. I moved in slow motion. The words, "sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone," described how I felt. I got to work, sat at my desk, and cried. I thought I might go home because I didn't feel like working, then realized that home would be worse. Somehow, I eased into my workday and eventually the weight lifted, and I began to concentrate on work. My life split into two hemispheres, the grinding tumult of my personal life and the quiet order of work. My concentration grew. Every once in a while, for a minute or two, or 5 or 15, I'd become absorbed enough to forget what I was grappling with. Those moments, when they happened, were a gift. Not only did they provide me with respite, but they connected me with the person I'd been before the tragedy, a reliable, capable person who could make a difference. Just as our friends were opening up to us about their own adolescent traumas and transgressions, so did my co-workers begin to share their personal experiences of shame and loss. Once again, I realized there was a vast wellspring of pain and suffering in the world, one I was now irrevocably tapped into. One co-worker's son was serving a prison sentence for attempted murder. Another shared her firsthand experience with depression, suicidal thoughts, and psychiatric hospitalization. Hearing these stories was both an honor and a lesson. When my associates entrusted me with their own painful histories, it reminded me that my crisis, as enormous and inescapable as it felt, was just my crisis. Other people suffered. They endured terrible things and they went on. It was good to be able to offer comfort, too, however meager. I didn't have anything profound to say, and anyway, who wanted advice from the mother of a murderer? But I could give just by listening. As I wrote in my journal, I've learned two important things. One, that there are many good, kind people out there. And two, There are many people who have suffered greatly and who keep going with strength and courage. These are the ones who can eventually support others. I hope I can be of use to someone someday. It would be a long road. The stripping away of my identity showed me how tied up I had been my whole life with ego. I had always wanted to be liked and had reveled in being a productive member of my community. I chose work through which I could help others. Feeling good about what I was doing had always been more important than making tons of money. I had taken great pride in my sons, in the family Tom and I had built, and in being a good mother. After Columbine, none of that could be true anymore. I wasn't just a bad mother, but the worst mother who ever was, openly hated on the front page of my local paper. Far from being liked and respected, the best I could hope for was that people around me could find some measure of compassion along with their horror and judgment. The challenge for myself was even steeper. I would never really be able to move beyond what Dylan had done. Like a cattle brand, the events at Columbine High School and my son's role in them had become an indelible part of who I was. To survive, I would have to find a way to live in this new reality. Short of ending my own life, there wasn't anything I could do about what the rest of the world thought. My new and greatest hope was simply integration, the old Sue with the new. Chapter 10. The End of Denial. Journal entry, October 1999. Right now, all I want to do is die. Tom keeps saying he wishes he had never been born. Dylan was so loved, but he didn't feel loved. I don't think he loved anyone or anything. How did it happen? I didn't know the boy I saw on those tapes today. My relationship with Dylan in my head and heart has changed. In October, 6 months after Columbine, the sheriff's department agreed to share the evidence they'd collected. They invited Tom and me to come in for a presentation of the material. My reaction to this news was complicated. After months of speculation and rumor and misinformation, it was a relief to know we would finally have the truth. At the same time, and for the same reason, I was petrified. As I wrote the week before, "The meeting will take more courage than I can muster. I can only have my own little construct of what really happened until I speak with the investigators. I don't want them to destroy the Dylan I'm holding on to in my mind." 2 days before we were scheduled to go in, Gary Lozo called. The sheriff's department had told him they would be presenting video evidence as part of their report and wanted to warn us that seeing it might be more painful than April 20th. Gary assumed they were referring to surveillance tape. Tom said he'd refused to watch footage of the massacre. I couldn't believe we were even discussing such a thing. If I had to see Dylan killing people, I'd go mad. The night before the meeting, Tom and I compiled a list of questions. We were still convinced that Dylan had either been a reluctant participant or accidentally become entangled in something bigger than he understood at the time. We'd heard a rumor that military training materials on brainwashing techniques had been found in the Harris home, which had refueled our belief that Dylan had been another victim of the tragedy. It was plausible. Mr. Harris did have a military background. I entertained fantasies that we'd be able to hold a public memorial service. But that was only a moment. I was coming to understand how fragile a construct we had created. Denial had been a necessary, indeed perhaps a life-saving, defense mechanism for me. As time went on, though, it was becoming more difficult to sustain. Much of what was reported in the media was wrong, which reinforced our skepticism. But we knew that Dylan had participated in the purchase of guns, and there were many credible eyewitness reports of Dylan shooting kids and of the hateful things he'd said. The cracks in my cobbled-together belief system were beginning to widen. As I suspected, the meeting at the sheriff's office would blow them wide open. Journal entry, October 1999. Today is really like the end of my life as I knew it before. If I learn horrible things tomorrow that I must carry with me from now on, I will look back on today and remember it as the end of a better time. We worked on our questions tonight. Byron gave me a long hug to help me face tomorrow. I hope tomorrow does not destroy the memory of the boy I loved. I don't know what this video is they want us to see. On the morning of October 8th, we went to the sheriff's department. We had met the lead investigator, Kate Batten, and another investigator, Randy West, when they had questioned us in our lawyer's office not long after the shootings. They'd been with us for our visit to the Columbine High School library. They were kind and profoundly professional in their interactions with us, and I was never more grateful for this than on that day. After our initial greeting, Tom and I sat on two of the chairs arranged in rows in a room set up for a formal presentation. I thought about the Harrises and about the other Columbine families. Sitting on the same chairs at different times seemed to be as close as we could be to each other. Pointing to various locations on the diagram of the school they'd set up on an easel, Kate and Randy began to tell the story of what Dylan and Eric had done on the morning of April 20th, 1999. It was the first time Tom and I learned from an official source what had happened that day and in the days leading up to it. The material that follows is graphic, and making the decision to include it here was not an easy one. The victims of this tragedy and their families have endured sorrows and hardships beyond measure, and I don't want a description of the event itself to reinvigorate the trauma they have already experienced. There is also evidence to suggest that describing how these crimes are committed may provide a roadmap for other disturbed individuals to follow, although eliminating graphic images and dramatic language and minimizing details mitigates the likelihood of contagion. That said, it is important to me to acknowledge the heinous acts Dylan and Eric committed prior to their deaths. Because so much of this book is focused on my love for Dylan, it is essential for me also to own the viciousness of his final moments on Earth. As a practice, I do not minimize the magnitude of what Dylan did in order to comfort myself, and I never, ever forget how I would feel if Dylan was one of the innocent people slaughtered or maimed that day. My intention here is to honor the precious children and the beloved teacher who were. Kate began to speak. The massacre had been carefully planned. The boys placed a small decoy bomb in a field about 3 miles away from the high school, hoping the explosion would distract emergency personnel from the events at the school. They drove to the school and entered the building around 11:15 with two duffel bags containing propane bombs. Outside, Eric ran into Brooks Brown, who reminded him about a test he'd missed. "It doesn't matter anymore," Eric said. "Brooks, I like you now. Get out of here. Go home." Dylan and Eric placed the bombs inside the cafeteria and headed back to their cars to wait. When the bombs in the cafeteria did not explode as planned, the boys came back together, climbed to the top of the steps outside the school's west entrance, and began shooting. Kate did not share with us the horrible details of what the boys said, how cruelly they treated some people, or where bullets or fragments of debris entered the bodies of the victims. She did her best to reduce the visual and auditory imagery, adhering instead to the chronological facts of who shot whom, which weapons had been used, and where at the school each individual had been injured. Intentional or not, I perceived this as an act of mercy, and I was grateful for it. Eric shot Rachel Scott, killing her instantly, and Richard Castaldo, who was hit multiple times and paralyzed below the chest. Eric then shot at Daniel Rohrbaugh and Sean Graves and Lance Kirkland, who were climbing the hill toward them, killing Daniel and wounding the other two. 5 students were sitting on the grass opposite the west entrance. Eric shot at them. Michael Johnson was hit but he ran and escaped with his life. Mark Taylor was also shot multiple times, but survived by pretending to be dead. The other three students ran. Dylan walked down the steps toward the cafeteria. He shot Lance Kirkland and stepped over Sean Graves on his way into the building. Eric, still outside, shot at several students sitting near the door to the cafeteria, paralyzing Anne-Marie Hochhalter. Without shooting at anyone or investigating the bombs in the cafeteria, Dylan rejoined him, and together they shot at a distant group of kids who had escaped over the chain-link fence to the soccer fields. They did not hit anyone. Patty Nielsen, a teacher, headed outside from the second floor to stop what she thought must be a video project or a prank. As she approached the doors of the west entrance, the boys shot out the glass in the doors, injuring a student, Brian Anderson, with flying glass, and hitting Nielsen in the shoulder. Nielsen ran into the library and told the students there to get under the tables. She hid under the library counter and called 911. Columbine's armed school guard, Deputy Neil Gardner, arrived in the parking lot. Eric shot at him, and Gardner shot back, but Gardner did not hit him. Gardner and another deputy from the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office also exchanged fire with Eric a little later, but no one was hit. The boys entered the building. Eric had shot his rifle 47 times. Dylan had shot 3 times with his handgun and 2 with his shotgun. The boys had also thrown pipe bombs. Eric and Dylan moved through a hallway, throwing pipe bombs and shooting at random. Stephanie Munson was injured by a bullet. Then Dave Sanders, who taught business at the school and who had evacuated a huge number of students from the cafeteria and personally seen them to safety, came around the corner looking for more people to warn. He and another student saw Dylan and Eric and turned to warn some others. Both boys shot down the hallway toward Dave Sanders. It's still not known whose shots killed him. Rich Long, another teacher, dragged him into a classroom where 2 students, Aaron Hansey and Kevin Starkey, administered first aid for 3 hours. Despite their efforts, he died later that afternoon, still waiting to be evacuated. Dylan and Eric threw 2 pipe bombs over the railing into the cafeteria below. These exploded. They threw a pipe bomb into the library hallway that also exploded. Then they went into the library. Eric shot at a desk where Evan Todd was hiding. Evan was hit, but not seriously injured. Dylan fatally shot Kyle Velasquez, who was hiding underneath a computer workstation. The boys reloaded and then began shooting out the window at the rescue workers helping the students outside. Dylan then shot at a table, injuring Daniel Stapleton and Mackay Hall. Eric shot under a desk without looking, fatally wounding Stephen Curnow, and then injured Casey Ruxhager. He walked over to another desk and killed Cassie Bernal. Dylan shot Patrick Ireland as he was helping Mackay Hall. Underneath another set of tables, Dylan found Isaiah Scholes, Matthew Kechter, and Craig Scott, Rachel Scott's younger brother. Dylan hurled racial epithets at Isaiah before Eric shot and killed him. Dylan then shot and killed Matthew Kechter. Eric threw a CO2 cartridge at the table where Mackay, Daniel, and Patrick were. Mackay managed to throw it away before it exploded. Eric began to shoot randomly. Dylan shot at a display case and then at the nearest table where he hit and injured Mark Kinchin. He shot again, injuring Lisa Kreutz and Valine Schnurr. Then he killed Lauren Townsend. Eric bent to taunt 2 girls under a table, then fired at Nicole Nolan and John Tomlin. When John tried to move away, Dylan killed him. Eric then shot Kelly Fleming, killing her instantly. He hit Lauren Townsend and Lisa Kreutz again, and wounded Gianna Park. The boys went to reload their weapons at a table. Eric noticed John Savage, a boy Dylan knew. John asked Dylan what they were doing, and he said, "Oh, just killing people." John asked if they were going to kill him. Dylan told him to leave. John fled. Eric shot and killed Daniel Mauser. Both Dylan and Eric then fired under another table, injuring Jennifer Doyle and Austin Eubanks, and fatally wounding Corey DePooter. The two of them found and taunted injured Evan Todd. Eric had broken his nose with his own shotgun's recoil and was bleeding heavily. The boys made their way to the library entrance. Dylan shot into the library break room, hitting a TV. He slammed a chair down on top of the library counter where Patty Nielsen was hidden. Then the two boys left the library. After they were gone, 30 uninjured survivors and 10 injured survivors evacuated the area. Patrick Ireland and Lisa Kreutz remained in the building. Patrick was unconscious, and Lisa could not move. Patty Nielsen, another teacher, and the two library staff members locked themselves into rooms adjoining the library. For the next 32 minutes, Eric and Dylan wandered through the school, firing their guns at random and setting off pipe bombs. Kate Batten pointed out to us how many people, probably between 200 and 300, were still left in the building. Many teachers and other staff had stayed in the building to warn and protect the remaining children. During the presentation, Kate reiterated how remarkable it was no one else had been killed. The boys went back to the cafeteria and tried to detonate the propane bombs they'd left there earlier. They looked through classroom windows, making eye contact with kids hidden there, but did not go into the rooms or shoot. They did not cause any further injury at all. They went back to the cafeteria and into the school kitchen. Then they returned to the library, where they again shot through the windows at police officers outside, before killing themselves. They left behind the biggest bombs of all in their cars, set to go off around noon. These did not detonate. Patrick Ireland regained consciousness and crawled to the library windows, where he fell into the arms of two SWAT team members standing on the roof of an armored truck. Lisa Kreutz, who sustained multiple gunshot wounds, was evacuated later in the afternoon, along with the four people hidden in the break room. One teacher, William Dave Sanders, was dead, along with 12 students: Cassie Bernal, Stephen Curnow, Corey DePooter, Kelly Fleming, Matthew Kechter, Daniel Mauser, Daniel Rohrbaugh, Isaiah Scholes, Rachel Scott, John Tomlin, Lauren Townsend, and Kyle Velasquez. 24 other students had been injured, 3 hurt as they tried to escape the school. I went completely numb as detailed information about the massacre rained down on us. It was like a documentary, so violent and depraved that I would never, ever, under ordinary circumstances, have watched it. A single fact had emerged, without any ambiguity at all. Dylan had done this thing. The event had been planned a long time in advance, and Dylan had participated in the planning. The attack had been carefully timed and strategically constructed. Dylan had deliberately killed and injured people. He had derided them as they begged for their lives. He had used racist, hateful language. He had not shown mercy, regret, or conscience. He had shot a teacher. He had killed children in cold blood. I was, and will always be, haunted by how those lives ended. For the first time in months, my eyes were dry. Not only could I not grasp what I had just heard, but I couldn't feel anything at all. Every belief I had created in order to survive had been shredded. The notepad filled with our questions sat unopened on my lap. As the details began to sink in, so did one of the most shocking and terrifying revelations of that morning. The destruction intended was of a far greater scope. The attack was really a failed attempt to blow up the entire school. The large propane bombs the boys had placed in the cafeteria had been timed to go off when the room was full of students, Because of a miscalculation, they did not explode. Kate said that if they had, a wall of fire would have enveloped the crowded cafeteria, trapping hundreds of students. The ceiling might have collapsed, bringing the whole second floor crashing down into the cafeteria. The horror of what happened then paled in comparison with what the boys had planned. I could barely breathe thinking about it. As catastrophic as the tragedy was, it could have been much, much worse. Indeed, that was what my son had intended. Gathering himself, Tom pressed for more information. The greatest mystery still had not been explained. What was Dylan's state of mind? Why was he there? What thoughts and feelings would cause him to take part in this atrocity? We believed Dylan had left absolutely no trace behind to explain his actions. The investigators had already told us he'd erased the hard drive on his computer, and they had taken from his room everything that might have given us insight into Dylan's frame of mind. We had searched and searched for a note. I'd asked his friends to look when they visited. They'd opened CD cases and rifled through books. None of us had found anything. So Tom and I were still clinging to one last shred of hope. It was obvious that Dylan had fully participated in the massacre, but had he done so willingly? Was it not possible that he might have been brainwashed or drugged or otherwise coerced? Kate shook her head and told us the police were sure Dylan had participated willingly. When we asked how she could be sure, she told us the boys had left behind a videotape. This was the video evidence we'd been warned about. Although the boys had taken video production classes together, it had never occurred to me that Dylan and Eric might have created a videotape of their own. The news that they had done so sent a jolt of terror and dread through my gut. Still, there was no way I could possibly have been ready for what I saw when Kate inserted the tape and hit play. Journal entry, October 1999. Once again, my life broke apart. If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. My worst fears have come to pass. I keep thinking about his crazy rage and his intent to die. He lied to us and to his friends. He was so far removed from feeling. I keep trying to understand how that sweet, beloved child got there. I'm so furious with God for doing this to my son. The basement tapes were videos of Dylan and Eric talking to the camera in various places and times in the weeks before the shootings. Many of them were shot in Eric's basement bedroom, which explains the name they were given by the media. We'd had no idea these videos existed. But as soon as the tape started to play, I realized I was going to have to let go of every one of my assumptions about my son's life and about the actions leading up to his death and the atrocities he committed. My heart nearly broke when I first saw Dylan and heard his voice. He looked and sounded just as I remembered him, the boy I had been missing so much. Within mere seconds, however, the words he was saying came into focus and my brain reeled. I stood up from my chair, wondering if I'd have time to get to the restroom before being sick to my stomach. He and Eric were preposterous, posturing, giving a performance for each other and their invisible audience. I had never seen that expression of sneering superiority on Dylan's face. My mouth gaped open when I heard the language they were using. Abominable, hate-filled, racist, derogatory words, words never spoken or heard in our home. The dynamic between the boys was laid bare, and it was a revelation. Adrenaline coursed through me, making it hard to concentrate, though the information on the tapes felt so important I didn't even want to blink. On the first recording, we saw Eric act as MC, introducing topics he once memorialized on the tape, while Dylan adds contemptuous support. At first glance, Eric seems like the calm, sane one, while Dylan rages in the background. It is obvious that Dylan's rage is a crucial component in the dynamic. Over and over, Eric urges him to Feel the Rage, and Dylan obliges by pulling out anything he can to lock himself into a state of anger and hold himself there. The lengths he goes to are ridiculous, as when he recalls slights from his preschool days. The psychologists who reviewed the tapes would come to a similar conclusion, that Eric relied on Dylan's slow-burning, depressive anger to fuel and feed his sadism, while Dylan used Eric's destructive impulses to jolt him out of his passivity. It would take years for me to filter what I heard on the tape and to understand the role of anger in Dylan's self-destruction. Through the appalling bravado and the shocking, hateful words spilling out of his mouth, I could see Dylan's familiar adolescent self-consciousness, the same awkward embarrassment he displayed whenever Tom brought out the video camera to make a home movie. I wanted to both leap through the screen and beat him with my fists while screaming at him, and in the same moment to reach back in time to hold him and tell him that he was deeply loved and not alone. I no longer remember the order in which the segments played. In one, the two boys sit in two chairs facing the camera, eating and drinking alcohol from a bottle. They list the people they want to hurt and describe what they would like to do to them. As Kate pointed out, none of the people mentioned on the tapes were injured in the attack. In another segment, Dylan holds the camera while Eric plays dress-up and shows off weapons. They talk about keeping the plan a secret. Eric shows how carefully he hid the weapons so his parents would not find them. Kate inserted a side comment here for our benefit. This portion of the video was a real eye-opener, she said, even for those who worked in law enforcement. Investigators had failed to discover one of Eric's hiding places in their initial search of the Harris's home. They'd had to go back after seeing the tape. She added that people on the team went home and searched their own children's rooms as they had never searched before. Dylan talks about sneaking his newly purchased shotgun into our house. He had sawed off the end, making it smaller and easier to conceal, not to mention illegal to own. He describes his tension as he held the gun inside his coat and slipped up to his room without being suspected. We've never learned whether the gun was stored inside our home or elsewhere. It might have been kept inside his box-shaped headboard. The inside could not be accessed unless the bed was taken apart. Watching, I felt hopeless. Even if we had continued to search his room, as we did regularly for 6 months after his arrest in junior year, we probably would not have looked there. At one point on the tape, Dylan makes a derogatory comment about my extended family, and another about his older brother, Byron. We had been grieving for 6 full months, and nobody had borne the brunt of the world's venom more bravely than Byron had. Our older son had stepped up and shouldered the terrible responsibilities that had landed on him with astonishing grace and courage. It was ironic. Dylan had so little to complain or be angry about that he was reduced to grasping at straws, like his relationship with his brother or rarely seen relatives, in order to stoke the rage Eric needed him to sustain. In another snippet of tape, Dylan complains to Eric that I am making him participate in a Passover Seder. On the weekend they made the video, I had decided to make a traditional Passover dinner and invite a neighbor to join us, and I asked both of my sons for their work schedules so I could plan accordingly. Dylan responded in a way I found immature and self-centered. He didn't want to participate. The youngest person at the table asked to read part of the service, and he found it embarrassing. I asked him to reconsider. I know this holiday means nothing to you, but it means something to me. We'll have a good dinner. Do it for me. When he said he would, I thanked him and told him I appreciated it. Then there he was on the video, complaining to Eric about his obligation to attend. Eric, who is playing with a gun while Dylan talks, becomes very still and silent when he hears the word Passover. He hadn't known my family was Jewish. When Dylan realizes what he has let slip, he starts backpedaling. He seems afraid of Eric's reaction and tells him, "I'm not really Jewish, just a quarter or an eighth." I couldn't tell if he was worried about being judged or being shot. Eric finally breaks the tension by offering a word of consolation to Dylan. Watching it, I thought, "You stupid idiots. All this talk about hating everyone and everything, and you don't even know what you're talking about. It's all something you've invented in your minds to sustain your anger." The heartbreaking thing was that for a moment there, it seemed like Dylan had almost realized it. At one point on the tapes, Eric suggests they each say something about their parents. At that, Dylan looks down at his fingernails and says almost inaudibly, "My parents have been good to me. I don't want to browse there." Neither one of them acknowledges a connection between the actions they are planning and the pain they will cause the people who love them. In another recording, they go so far as to announce that their parents and friends hold no responsibility for what is about to happen, as if tidying this minor detail will make everything fine for their families when it's all over. The last segment was the shortest one. It was also the most difficult for me. In it, the boys pause to say a few words of farewell before going over to the school to carry out their plan. Supplies are piled around them, as if they are heading out on an expedition. Eric tells his family how they should distribute his possessions. Dylan does not utter an angry word or speak of hatred or vengeance. He makes no mention of the death and destruction to come. There is none of the braggadocio of the previous tapes. He does not cry either. His affect is flat, resigned. Whatever else he intends to do, he is going to the school to end his own life. He looks away from the camera as if speaking only to himself. Then he says softly, "Just know I'm going to a better place. I didn't like life too much." Watching this, I had to bite my lip to stop myself from screaming, "Stop! Stop! Don't go! Don't leave me! Don't do this! Don't hurt those people! Give me a chance to help you. Come back." But wherever he was, Dylan couldn't hear me anymore. Notes from a conversation with sociologist Zeynep Tufekci, February 2015. She said, "I can see no benefit whatsoever to releasing those tapes, only the possibility for great harm." Years later, Tom and I would fight to make sure the so-called basement tapes were not released to the public. We encountered a lot of resistance. People believed we were hiding something, or protecting Dylan's reputation. As I dryly commented to Tom the first time we heard that particular accusation, "I think that horse has already left the barn." I was even challenged by some survivors of suicide loss. "Don't you think making the tapes public would help people to understand why this happened?" The answer was, "No, I don't. I still don't. And my reasons are closely interwoven with many of the broader global issues surrounding suicide and violence at the heart of this book. Specifically, the real fear that another disturbed child would use the tapes as a blueprint or a model for their own school shooting." Dylan and Eric had already been, in certain quarters, heralded as champions for a cause. Tom and I had received chilling letters from alienated kids expressing admiration for Dylan and what he'd done. Adults who had been bullied as children wrote to tell us they could relate to the boys and their actions. Girls flooded us with love letters. Young men left messages on our answering machine calling Dylan a god, a hero. An acquaintance working at a youth correctional facility told me some of the imprisoned boys cheered as they watched television coverage of the destruction at the school. A video project Dylan and Eric had made, leaked to the media, had become a rallying cry for bullied kids. These communications made me sadder and sicker than the most castigating hate mail. If the tapes were made public, we would never be able to control who could see them. Even writing about the timeline of the events at the school and describing the tapes as I have done in this chapter makes me nervous, and I would not have done so without getting an explicit go-ahead from people who study these issues. We could not, in good conscience, release the tapes. Enough harm had been done. This wasn't mere superstition on our part. As the years went on, our fears that Dylan and Eric's actions would provide inspiration to other disturbed kids were confirmed over and over again. Columbine-related materials were found among Virginia Tech shooter Sung-hee Cho's possessions and in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooter Adam Lanza's belongings. An investigation by ABC News, published in 2014, found at least 17 attacks and another 36 alleged plots or serious threats against schools since the assault on Columbine High School that can be tied to the 1999 massacre. We know without a doubt that exposure to suicide or suicidal behavior can influence other vulnerable people to make an attempt. Over 50 studies worldwide have powerfully connected news coverage of suicides to an increased incidence of similar or copycat suicides. This effect is called suicide contagion. It's also known as the Werther effect, a term coined by sociologist David Phillips in the 1970s. The name itself highlights how long we've known about the phenomenon. In the 18th century, a host of young men imitated the protagonist of Goethe's novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, dying by suicide, dressed as he did, in yellow pants and a blue jacket. The media's acknowledgement of the Werther effect has unquestionably saved lives. Perhaps you've noticed that suicide deaths, especially those of teenagers, are rarely reported in the news. That's not accidental. It's because media outlets are following guidelines endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institute of Mental Health, both of which suggest that limiting and dampening coverage may save lives. The guidelines recommend that media outlets avoid repetitive, glamorizing, or sensational coverage and should not offer simplistic explanations for suicide. Methods should not be graphically discussed. Final notes should not be reprinted. Photographs of the location of the death, of memorial sites, and of grieving family members may be inflammatory and should be avoided. By agreeing to report on suicides, not as if they were high-profile crimes, but as part of a massive public health problem, members of major media outlets have saved lives. Two areas of exception are death by suicide of a high-profile celebrity and murder-suicide. Now, I'm not naive enough to believe I will ever see a world where there is no coverage surrounding the death of a well-known figure like Robin Williams, or of an event like the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School. As tragic as these events may be, they are also news stories. But there are many ways even these events can be covered more responsibly, and there is a strong argument for doing so. I believe, in particular, there is a compelling argument for changing the way we cover murder-suicide. A growing body of research suggests that the rising number of mass shootings in the United States is inextricably linked, along with the easy availability of high-capacity guns and a lack of knowledge about and support for brain health issues, to the way the media cover these events. And if such media coverage can either contain or instigate contagion, then I agree with media experts like Drs. Frank Ochberg and Zeynep Tufekci that it is imperative to institute a new set of guidelines for reporting on murder-suicide. There is, of course, already a material difference between the way these events are covered by legitimate mainstream news organizations and what happens in the deepest, darkest corners of the Internet or even on cable news with 24 hours of programming to fill. Meg Moritz, a journalist and professor who has looked closely at the media coverage of Columbine, reminded me that the journalists in question are often making split-second decisions under less than optimal circumstances. Even so, it's not unreasonable to expect legitimate news organizations to follow best practice guidelines. Many of these guidelines are don'ts. Don't show images of the shooter, particularly ones of him with weapons, or in the outfit he chose to carry out the massacre. Don't show the weapons used or other evidence. Don't endlessly repeat the name of the shooter. Instead, refer to the killer or the perpetrator. Don't give airtime or publish the videos they make, like the basement tapes, or manifestos posted to their social media accounts. Don't compare the killer to other killers, particularly by putting emphasis on how many people they have killed. Tufekci believes that numbers, how many dead and injured, the number of bullets fired, and photographs are particularly inflammatory as they provide a benchmark for competition. Don't sensationalize the violence or the body count with remarks like, the most people killed and injured in the country's history. Don't oversimplify the motivations behind the act. Most important, don't inadvertently make heroes out of the killers. It seems obvious, and yet when an event like this happens, you can't avoid detailed, and I would argue fetishistic, descriptions of the weapons used, how the killers hid their arsenals, what they did and ate on the fateful day, exactly what they wore. Their names become household names. We know their favorite foods, video games, movies, and bands. These details may eventually emerge, of course. Leaks happen, and the internet is the internet. But if these images and details accelerate and inspire violence, then they should not be endlessly repeated on CNN. Dr. Frank Ochberg is a psychiatrist, a pioneer in trauma science, and the chairman emeritus of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University. When he educates journalists about trauma, he advises them to broaden the discussion around traumatic events instead of sensationalizing them. Which details will genuinely help us to unravel the events that have taken place? What resources can we point people to? How can we set this tragedy in a larger context of mental health? One of the biggest improvements would simply be to refrain from jumping to conclusions, especially by oversimplifying root causes. School shooters don't kill people because of violent video games or techno music, and people don't die by suicide because they've lost a job or been dumped by a girlfriend. Many articles I read in the wake of Robin Williams' death expressed shock that a man so wealthy and beloved could feel he had nothing to live for. Of course, money and popularity don't protect people from brain illness any more than they cause it. When we oversimplify the cause of a suicide, we create risk by suggesting that a romantic rejection or a setback at work is a reason to consider death. A firing or a breakup might contribute to someone's despondency, but people get dumped and fired all the time. These events by themselves cannot explain why someone dies by suicide. Similarly, violent video games have been shown to desensitize kids to the reality of violence, and they are likely particularly dangerous for vulnerable kids who are struggling with brain illness or other cofactors. But school shooters don't go on rampages because they played Grand Theft Auto or Doom. It's my hope that the recommendations I have made here won't be seen as pro-censorship or a threat to free speech, but as a call for ethical reporting. In an act I respect greatly, the novelist Stephen King asked his publisher to withdraw his novel, Rage, after a number of school shooters quoted from it. The iconic Columbine photograph is a still from the surveillance tape showing Dylan and Eric in full paramilitary garb, brandishing their weapons in the school cafeteria. Whenever I see it, especially when it accompanies an article that purports to be taking a more constructive approach, I have to stop myself from throwing the magazine across the room. Certainly there is a precedent for changing the way the media report events with an eye to the greater good. A good reporter would never dream of publishing a sexual assault victim's name or specific troop movements. Perhaps it will soon become similarly unthinkable to publish a killer's mugshot over the number of people he killed and injured in bright blood red. Some news organizations have begun to listen. In 2014, a conservative Canadian network made the decision